Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Everybody's heard of Halley's Comet. It rounds the sun and passes by Earth every 70 years, every 80 years. It's a little bit different each time, but it comes back. It's regular. And we have our own comet in the form of Dr. Elena Cernant, who every year appears from the darkness of space, or we'll call that the Education Committee of SBGAN, and presents for us, as she nears the sun and circles back out, the most interesting abstracts, in her opinion, from the SBGAN annual meeting, which this year is taking place in Helsinki, where we are, your podcast team, along with Elena. Elena comes from Romania, entered university there, went on to university further in Spain, took her pediatric training there, and went all over the globe, so far as her CV is any guide, until she wound up as a consultant in pediatric gastroenterology and hepatology in Leeds, United Kingdom, where she continues to work. Have I got that right, more or less?
Yes.
Well, it's great to see you again as you make that brilliant, blazing pass through our skies.
Thank you, Alex, and it's great to see you again this year also. Once again, the annual meeting is a tremendous success with over 5,700 participants, more than 1,500 high-quality abstracts, and over 200 world-renowned speakers. It's just an amazing event. But really what I truly admire about this Congress is the organizer's continuous drive to innovate and improve. Every year, they manage to bring something new to the table, and this year is no exception. For instance, there is a brand new course added to the usual lineup of PIGAN, pediatric IBD, allied health professional courses, and this is a hands-on introduction to artificial intelligence. Last year, we had some sessions on artificial intelligence, but now, with its rapid expansion, we have a full course dedicated to teach us how AI tools can be used in both daily clinical work and research. How exciting is that? We also have two new workshops, one focused on parental nutrition and another, the Young SBGAN workshop, tailored specifically for our young colleagues. I'm also thrilled to see that the AHPs, such an essential part of our society, now have a dedicated AHP station within the endoscopy learning zone. And let's not forget another exciting addition, the Experts Dialogue session, which helps navigate challenging cases in a very interactive way. For those interested, there is even an opportunity to complete step one of the intestinal ultrasound hands-on qualifying program. This technique is such a novel development in the world of pediatric gastroenterology and could make a real difference to the patient care.
Oof. You said a mouthful. And I think we have to remember, make time in your schedule in 2026 to attend next year's annual meeting, which will be held in Lille in France.
So let's go to the abstracts now.
Right. The first one you've picked is from Israel. It is from Gavriel Fialkov and others. At a double handful of Israeli institutions, and it deals with a CF-CHIP SEQ liquid biopsy for the diagnosis of autoimmune hepatitis in children. Now, I'm going to make things a little bit clearer for you, because CF-CHIP, CFCHP-SEQ, as they've spelled it out, is chromatin immunoprecipitation and sequencing. And I'm sure that we're all glad that we can just say CHP-SEQ. How would you say that, Elena?
I'll go with the full name, cell-free chromatin-immunoprecipitation sequencing, probably.
You're a better woman than I am. What can I tell you? What do you think of this abstract?
So I was impressed with this study that I think could revolutionize the way to diagnose autoimmune hepatitis. As you are very well aware, the autoimmune hepatitis is usually diagnosed with a liver biopsy. That it's an invasive technique. So here the researchers have tested a non-invasive method, a liquid biopsy, as you said, specifically cell-free chromatin immunoprecipitation sequencing which detects gene activity from dying liver cells. They analyzed blood from 95 autoimmune hepatitis patients and compared it to healthy controls and patients with other liver diseases. Here is the breakthrough. Autoimmune hepatitis patients show a distinct transcriptional signature, meaning a unique pattern of gene activity related to liver inflammation and immune regulation. Key genes linked to hepatic inflammation and immune-mediated liver pathology were significantly elevated. These were used to create an autoimmune hepatitis score, which correctly identified autoimmune hepatitis with a very high level of diagnosis accuracy. Even better, when they cross-checked with RNA sequencing data from actual liver biopsies, the results matched completely. So probably, if validated further, this technique could reduce the need for liver biopsies, make diagnosis faster, and offer new insights into the autoimmune hepatitis pathogenesis, all from a simple blood draw. But of course, as a liver histopathologist, you are the expert in this area. So what is your opinion about this new technique, the liquid biopsy? Do you think this is the future of the liver condition? And not only, maybe.
Well, Elena, I think that this is absolute rubbish. R-U-B-B-I-S-H, and let me tell you why. We don't make the diagnosis of autoimmune hepatitis on the basis of a liver biopsy. We make the diagnosis of autoimmune hepatitis on the basis of a clinical presentation and the presence of autoantibodies. We do a liver biopsy in order to stage what we think is autoimmune hepatitis. Sometimes we come up with something different. Sometimes we don't. But most often, and I come from the liver unit that sailed under the proud flag of Professor Georgina Miele Vergani and Professor Diego Vergani. And if they caught me saying anything other than that serology was the way to make a diagnosis of autoimmune hepatitis, my life wouldn't be worth two snaps of my fingers. So how are you going to... This is a lovely, lovely example of using a technique to answer the wrong question. What we have here is demonstration of inflammation in a particular pattern. And yes, that inflammation coincides with the histopathologic and clinical diagnosis of autoimmune hepatitis. But it clearly doesn't tell you how bad things are. All right. You got to come back?
Yes, I got it.
Okay. Come on. This is supposed to be a fight. What do you think?
I think everything that it's new and it shows something, I think we could try it and see. And always it's a new technique that probably will need more cases, will need more things to validate.
And need more funding. Don't forget, need more funding.
And funding, always funding, yes.
Well, I take the bread out of my children's mouths if you must. Eliminate the liver biopsy. But I tell you, you're still going to need to know how much fibrosis is present. And really, for years to come, nobody's going to believe whatever the results are of this new technique until they've actually compared them with a liver biopsy specimen and the histopathologic interpretation.
And I think it's what the authors are planning to do for now, at least.
Well, good luck to them. We'll go on to the second then. The second abstract, gut microbiota response to ileal bile acid inhibitor therapy in children with progressive familial intrahepatic cholestasis. From Dr. Schulze, Cora Schulze, and others based in Hanover, Germany. What made you think this was a good idea to present here?
So if you remember, last year we discussed about the new ileal bile acid transport inhibitors that increase the transfer of primary bile acid to the colon. And we also know that the liver transplantation restores normal bile flow completely. But how are these treatments affecting the gut microbiota, which metabolizes the bile acids? So to answer these questions, researchers analyzed gut microbiota from 31 children with PFIC across different treatment stages. Untreated, on IBAT inhibitor and post-liver transplant, and compare them to healthy controls. The key findings were PFIC patients had reduced bacterial count and impaired gut microbiota function as expected. even though IBAT inhibitor increases bile acid delivery to the colon, the microbiota didn't show an improved capacity to metabolize bile acids, but some patients on IBAT inhibitor showed microbiome improvement over time, especially those who responded well to therapy. Liver transplantation nearly normalized the gut microbiome. In conclusion, PFIC disrupts the gut microbiome significantly. Liver transplant almost normalizes microbiota in PFIC, while IBAT inhibitor does not. If the microbiota improves post-IBAT inhibitor treatment, this is associated with response to therapy. So this was the summary of the abstract. Of course, I think this study, it's good, but has a big limitation that it's a very small number of patients, really.
Oh, well, this, the presentation of this study saddens me. And it saddens me because PFIC is a wastebasket. We have genes now, people. We have genes and genes whose products are expressed either in the liver or in the liver and at extrahepatic sites. One of the principal forms of PFIC, PFIC1 or ATP8B1 disease, definitely involves abnormalities of the gut mucosa. And for this study not to differentiate among at least ABCB11 disease, bile salt export pump deficiency, ATP8B1 disease, FIC1 deficiency, and ABC4 disease is, I think, a great shame. I wonder if this is only a matter of lacking space to differentiate among them in the abstract. But if this were to reach me as a manuscript without strong genetic correlation, I would say, send it back.
I'm imagining that when they will have more numbers of patients, they could do the classification. So probably that will be the future even. And maybe if they have it like classified, they can see which patients on IBAT inhibitors showed increased gut microbiome diversity and those who not.
Let's just say that I hope strongly that before this comes to publication, it will be substantially expanded, improved, and revised. Are we ready for number three?
Yes, we are.
Abstract number three, a set of serum proteomic biomarkers differentiate celiac children from age and HLA match controls. Roberta Mandile is the first author here in an article or an abstract that comes from medical centers in Italy and in the Netherlands. Take it away, Elena.
So yes, I found this abstract very interesting, as maybe we could say goodbye to the biopsies for celiac disease forever. Even though the new guidelines that Espagan has published and are followed in the majority of Europe have reduced the need for intestinal biopsies in celiac disease, more than half of the cases still require one. But what if a simple blood test could do the job? Again, a liquid biopsy. In this study, researchers tested 92 inflammation-related proteins in the bloods of 50 children with celiac disease and compared them to 50 genetically at risk but healthy controls. Using multivariate analysis, they identified a set of 8 biomarkers that could correctly identify celiac disease in about 90% of the cases. That means we are one step closer to a non-invasive blood-based diagnosis tool that could reduce the need for biopsies and enable more personalized diagnosis.
Elena, you know, you just present these cases in order to vex and tease me. That's what you do. Because you know I'm not going to argue in favor of eliminating biopsy, whether it's of liver or whether it's of small bowel mucosa. My problem with this abstract is the fact that it compares celiac disease not with other forms of intestinal inflammation, but with normal controls. In one, they found inflammation. In one, they didn't. In one, they found inflammation-associated biomarkers, and in the other, they didn't. Do you want to guess which one they found the inflammation-associated biomarkers in? The celiac disease patients. But can these biomarkers differentiate celiac disease from another form of intestinal inflammation? I don't think that this study lets us know.
I think with celiac, it's a little bit simple because we are not really looking for inflammation. When we suspect a case, for example, we have positive anti-transglutaminase antibodies or anti-endomysium antibodies, you are suspecting it's celiac, so you don't really compare with other type of enteropathies, for example, or inflammation. So if you have that already, the antibody is positive, and this will help you diagnose it without the endoscopy, why not? Even now, for example, the guidelines that we are following now, if you have antibodies, anti-transglutaminase antibodies, more than 10 times the normal values in two occasions, and positive anti-endomysium antibodies, you have a diagnosis and you don't really need the biopsy. So if we can eliminate it forever, why not?
Why? What? The only phrase that comes to mind at the moment is wicked women. Let's just move along to the next abstract, please, which is long-term maintenance treatment with vedolizumab in pediatric inflammatory bowel disease, a 3-year follow-up of the prospective multicenter VedoKids study.
Yes, so I think I'm always presenting something with IBD because I always want to know more about the relatively new treatments for IBD, and I found this study really interesting. Here, the researchers follow 137 children from 17 centers with Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis that were on a treatment with vedolizumab. After 3 years, 39 were still on a treatment, and complete remission, defined as steroid-free, symptom-free, with normal labs, was achieved by 26% of the UC patients and 14% of the Crohn's disease patients. Remission was more sustainable in UC than Crohn's disease, as described previously. The key finding? Week 6 response strongly predicted long-term success. Kids who showed early clinical improvement were more likely to be in remission at year 3. Importantly, no serious side effects were linked to the drug. So, vedolizumab appears safe and moderately effective for long-term use in children, especially for UC. Early response, it's a strong sign of future success.
I'm all in favor of studies that enable better prognostication. And that sounds like that seems to be the principal strength among the results of this study, that after six weeks, say to a set of parents, it's going to be okay, as opposed to, we're going to have to rethink this and start something else, and no, we're not going to wait for it to get better on its own, because if it ain't working by 6 weeks, it ain't going to work.
And yeah, I think I'm of the same opinion as you this time.
Okay.
This 6 weeks period it's very important because, for example, in my clinical experience, for example, you start them on this drug and sometimes you have the idea, they will respond to it, but we have to wait a little bit longer and a little bit longer, and they are symptomatic, and really this is not good. So I think what I would like to ask the authors really will be, what are the implications, their opinion, of the finding that they are responding better after 6 weeks? And how might this inform future treatment protocols or early intervention? Should we do things differently? Should we have a protocol about this?
Well, you'll have to talk to the authors. But before you do that, let's take a look at Abstract 5, which is mechanisms of the fetal regulatory B-cell induction by 2' fucosyl lactose supplementation during pregnancy for allergy prevention. Wow. This comes from France. France and Denmark. How about that? And it certainly seems to be an interesting piece of work.
It is. I'm not a specialist in basic research, but the finding that a sugar in a mother's diet during pregnancy helps prevent food allergies in children, it's really very interesting. So they investigated how supplemented pregnant mice with 2-fucosyl lactose, or 2FL, a human milk sugar, influences fetal immune development. Prior research showed that 2FL helps prevent food allergy in offspring by increasing B10 regulatory cells, which promote immune tolerance. However, it was unclear if these B10 cells originated from the mother or developed within the fetus. Using a mouse model that distinguished maternal and fetal immune cells, researchers found that 2FL supplementation during pregnancy significantly increased B10 cells in maternal and fetal bone marrow, as well as in the placenta. Notably, both maternal and fetal origin B10 cells were elevated in fetal tissues, indicated that maternal cell may cross into the fetus, maternal microchimerism, and contribute to the tolerogenic environment. In conclusion, maternal 2FL intake promotes immune tolerance in the fetus, partly through the transfer of maternal B10 cells, potentially protecting against food allergies. Of course, further studies are needed to confirm this, how these cells function in the long term.
Well, the point that at which this study stops is exactly the point at which I wish it had gone further, which is the idea, as they write, that further studies are needed to confirm maternal B10 functionality in older offspring. You've got these B10 cells that come from the mama. How long do they stick around? Do they establish a population that will continue to affect immune system function and development into maturity in these mice? They don't tell us, and I sure wish they had.
I'm hoping for next year we're going to have another answer, so...
Okay. Drop of water on stone is all I can say. I hate waiting like this, but we're going to have to. And our last abstract for today, that is from the Czech Republic. D-lactate in pediatric patients on enteral and long-term parenteral nutrition. Well, what about D-lactate?
So D-lactate, it's a form of lactate mainly produced by gut bacteria, and it can accumulate in the body under certain conditions like short bowel syndrome. In this study, researchers measured D-lactate levels in both serum and urine across four groups. Children on long-term parenteral nutrition, those who had bowel adaptation after short bowel syndrome, children on enteral nutrition, and healthy controls on a normal diet. The key finding was that children with bowel adaptation off parenteral nutrition had significantly higher D-lactate levels in both serum and urine compared to healthy children. No significant differences were found amongst the other groups. The researchers also checked for genetic mutations in the LDHD enzyme, which helps break down D-lactate, but found no pathogenic variants, suggesting that elevated levels are likely due to metabolic or microbial changes, not genetics. Importantly, the study also established reference D-lactate levels for healthy children, which can help guide future clinical assessments.
Now, what are we supposed to do with this information, Elena? How are if we measure D-lactate in our patients, then where do we go after we get the value back?
So I think, because, you know, this is my area of interest and it's close to my heart, I think here what it's essential is to discuss how important it is to follow up short bowel patients that achieve bowel adaptation. And unfortunately, this is not always happening. Despite the fact that they are off PN, they are still at high risk of complications like micronutrients, vitamin deficiencies, small bowel bacterial overgrowth, oxalate kidney stones, and of course, raised D-lactate identified by this study. So they still have to be monitored. If the D-lactate is really raised, they can present even with D-lactic acidosis that it's a proper encephalopathy. So it's really important to recognize this.
Well, that's why we're glad to have people like you with insight into these conditions to help us interpret these abstracts. I'm really impressed with the breadth and even depth of what's been shown here, although I do disagree with some of the ways it was presented. Well, thank you, Elena. They always say, thank you for looking at the abstracts for me so I don't have to.
You're welcome, Alex.
But now, we need something else from you. And that is a contribution of, as always, something for the Espigan favorite song playlist on Spotify. We're in Finland.
So
Finland is climbing to the top of the Eurovision Song Contest contenders. What do you want to show? What do you want to recommend for us?
I think I will go for a traditional Finnish polka. So let's go for it.
So forget Eurovision and go for the polka?
Yes.
Okay.
More traditional.
Thank you again.
Nice to see you.